Welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist and one of my best friends.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what? You stood by me, and I'll never forget it. And it's probably, I get asked about you more than I get asked about my sobriety.
No.
I swear I do. People want to know what Dr. Matt's like, if he's really that cool, and if I can get him in to see you.
You're like, no, he's not that cool.
I go, no, he is cool. I said, the thing I love about Dr. Matt is he is a doctor. You got a PhD, right?
I do.
But you don't talk like you have one.
There may be other reasons for that, but yeah, sure.
No, it's not a diss. What I mean is that you speak like all of us, and you know what I mean? You're not talking down to us. A lot of times when you talk to somebody who's got a PhD behind their name,
yeah,
they're talking down to you.
That's annoying, and I think that happens a lot with people I know, yeah. So I'm just a regular small-town guy, you know.
From Morgan.
Doing the best I can.
Yeah, you are, and I love it. Hey, so I've got some things that I want to talk to you about before we get to our guest, and one of the things is that when I'm out and about, mm-hmm. and I'm talking to people, and my recovery gets brought up either by me or by them, you know, often I'll hear from somebody, it's got to be a fight every day.
Mm.
And I go, well, yeah, kind of.
Does it have to be, though?
And that's my point. I think for the first, now here's the thing, it's because people say once an addict, always an addict. And I don't dispute that. I don't dispute that. Yeah. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. But a fight every day, I don't think it has to be a fight for every day. I think, and hear me out. Like the first week, I was fighting tooth and nail.
Oh, I'm
the
sure.
First month,
yeah.
I was giving it all I got. And I still am giving it all I got, but it's not a constant fight. It's not something that I wake up with and go, okay, let's put on the gloves and let's go toe-to-toe. When I think of a fight, I think drop down, drag them out, kind yeah. of swinging with everything you got. To me, that's a fight. Every day, I recognize this disease. Mm-hmm. I show it its utmost importance in my life, but I don't fight it every day. And I don't think it has to be a fight every day.
Well, I think that's the promise and potential of and difference between living life in recovery versus just trying to be sober. Like living life in recovery means that you're elevating every aspect of your life and the different aspects of your life support each other and support your sobriety. So I think over time, the more a person considers themselves living in, and that doesn't mean you slack. It doesn't mean you pretend you don't have a problem. You go back into denial. It's quite the opposite. You're mindful every day that that's something that you have to attend to and do maintenance for.
I acknowledge it.
But why would you want to do it for the rest of your life if every day is a total fight, right? Like that's not a reward.
No. And I think this goes back to what's very important in the world of recovery. It's boundaries. And it's respecting mm-hmm. boundaries and setting those boundaries. So my boundary is hard and simple. I do not drink alcohol. Why? Because if I do, I can't control myself. So I just don't do that. I'm not dancing with it. I'm not drinking cough syrup. I'm not trying to skirt around the issue. I go, that's a boundary that I cannot cross. And I know that. It took me a while to get there, mm-hmm. but I do know that now.
And I know for a long time, for most of you, I think from the beginning, but certainly after the first 6 months or so, you've had full commitment to that. You're not trying to almost drink alcohol, or, you know, people are like, well, I just have a non-alcoholic beer, or, you know, it's like, no. It's full commitment is very empowering.
It's interesting you bring up the non-alcoholic beer, because mm-hmm. people have asked me, they go, do you want a non-alcohol?
Duels.
And I'll go, why? I never drank because I like the taste. I mean, I learned to love the taste,
yeah,
but
yeah.
it wasn't the taste that got right. me going. You know what I mean?
Let's be honest. The people that are beer connoisseurs, you never start off that way.
No.
Because it tastes foul.
And for me, I just know in my mind, that is a slippery slope.
Yeah.
That is a slippery slope for me, is to be drinking a non-alcoholic beer.
I would think for sure for anybody who's got a drinking problem.
Now, for those who use it and it works for them, and then
yeah, sure.
Great. That's yeah. good for you. But for me, no. I mean,
it just feels like that's back to this whole idea of maintenance. It's like, why do anything that sort of makes it a little more challenging? Now, so somebody's going to message us that we're crazy and that's what works for them. And I think you and I are both of the same mind that if something really works for a person, that's great for them.
Yeah.
And we're not judging it. But for the majority of people, making a complete commitment to no alcohol and not trying to skirt around the margins of that.
Because addicts, that's where we live, and that's skirting around.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's where we really excel. Mm-hmm. That's what we're really good at, yep, is pushing the envelope. And
that gray area, baby. That,
man, I lived in that gray area.
Yeah.
I was way more than 50 Shades of Grey.
You know what I mean? I didn't need to know that part.
No, I mean, not in the book sense, but as I yeah, mean, yeah, I know, everything I was gray in my
yeah,
world.
Yeah, right. No.
And
sure.
So now there's a hard line. I do not drink. And so I respect that boundary, and it's not a fight every day.
But recently you went to a golf charity event,
mm-hmm,
and people were drinking pretty heavily.
Yeah.
And for you, that's a double whammy from a psychologist's point of view. It's like, okay, there are people around you drinking. That's one potential trigger, but it's associated with the place that you drank the most.
Golfing.
Maybe not the most, but
a lot.
It never didn't go together.
Yeah.
Right. And so how did you manage that commitment when you're there, everybody's drinking? You probably could have snuck drinks and no one even noticed after the first few holes because they were getting so wasted.
Yeah.
So like you probably could have even done it on the DL. How do you manage those triggers?
Well, because I think I'm resolved in my sobriety. I that's it. And once again, it's I'm not drinking because I can't. I'm not drinking because I don't choose to. You know what I mean? And that was the difference in my sobriety. Like, and I remember people like, you know, even if you wanted to drink, I wouldn't let you. I appreciate the sentiment. And I know where you're going with this. Mm-hmm. But if I'm an alcoholic, if I want to get a drink,
yeah,
I will get a drink. Yeah. I can walk into Maverick. I can walk into Smith's. I can walk into any of these stores and my picture's not hung up there. And I could go buy beer. I could buy whatever it is. And if I want to drink, I'm going to drink.
Yeah.
So I don't drink because I don't drink. And I'm not trying to skirt the issue. And I'm happy in my life. I like what I'm doing. Now, the double-edged sword for me is I like the debauchery. I like those guys. Yeah. I like what they represent. I like the fun that they have. And I went and had as much fun as I wanted until I didn't. And then I bowed out. And so 10:30.
You went home and got a good night's rest.
Yeah, 10:30 at night. I said, I'm going to bed. And they go, it's 10:30. I go, yeah, I'm tired.
Yeah.
You know, and I just went to bed. And
well, I like that because that's an interesting thought. If you break that down for a second, it's like you're focusing on things that you really enjoyed and doing them that were associated with alcohol, but you're having more fun without the alcohol. One is just the good time, the partying with your friends. The other is golf. And you've said 100 times you're a much better golfer and have more fun golfing now.
You know how
you didn't give up golf and the friends. You just gave up the alcohol.
You know how much money you can win betting a drunk golfer? It's pretty amazing.
I may not be able to, but good golfers could.
You know, but that's the thing is, and I still like the debauchery. I mean, I do, and I don't mean debauchery. But
I know you're a fun loving guy.
Yeah,
that's your personality.
I like the ruckus behavior. I like the cards. I like the messing around and stuff like that. And once again, is once I got to my sobriety and says I don't drink because I don't drink. Mm-hmm. No other reason than that. I am not the best person I can be with alcohol in my system.
Right.
And so I don't drink because I'm not good at it. Yeah. And it's as simple as that. You can drink. You can do whatever you want. I normally duck out of the party when somebody's talking to my shoulder, explaining the world's problems. And I got to act like I care.
Deep philosophy.
You know, and I got to go, hey, listen, this is just painful for both of us. I'm going to go to bed and you'll find somebody else to talk to and everything will be cool.
Yeah, you just stare them away.
Yeah. And then I'll wake you guys up in the morning. And I woke up in the morning, made everybody eggs and breakfast and that stuff. And it was a blast. Had a great time.
Good.
And I love those. So I guess what I'm saying is when you get into your recovery, you got to get into it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the only way it stays. And
we've had a lot of guests, and we've said this before. It sort of, I didn't understand it, and it rubbed me a little bit the wrong way when guests would come on and they say that I prioritize my sobriety above everything else, including my spouse, my family, my job, even God. It's number one.
Because anything I put above that will be the first things I lose if I relapse.
And I get that now, and it makes sense. And that attitude carries the day. Like, if it really is your number one priority and you can live in recovery, not just white knuckle through sobriety, then you open yourself up to enjoy all those other beautiful relationships and things in your
life. If I don't remain sober, I don't get to do any of that other stuff.
Right, right.
And so it's as simple as that. So I acknowledge it every day. I understand it. I respect it. But I don't fight it every day.
And you have your routines.
I have my
routines.
You're
up early. You're going to the gym. You're working.
A bigger fight with me daily is getting myself to the gym.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
You know what I mean? And that's a bigger fight for me daily. Not to pick up a beer.
But that shows your progress,
yeah,
right?
Not a big fight. Yeah. But making me go to the gym, yeah, it's like, come on, man.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I appreciate you taking some time and listening to me. And that's what this podcast is about. When we started it 4.5 years ago, it was to kind of talk about my story and my fight.
I actually kind of thought, you know, if people have been listening since the beginning, there was a little TV kickoff and there was like an extra long episode talking about your experience and mm-hmm. you were very open and candid and authentic. And I thought it may not go much beyond that. But guess what? There are a lot of addicts out there.
Oh, it's crazy.
And so, families of addicts and friends of addicts. And alcohol is no respecter of persons. And drugs and alcohol are everywhere in our community. And it just so turns out mm-hmm. that there's a lot of people that related to your story.
So this morning I was doing a live TV for KSL here in Salt Lake City, Utah. And we're at this thing called the Pinners Conference. And basically what it is, a bunch of people who love Pinterest get together and share their ideas. And you can go there and do a bunch of make and takes.
Isn't that what you already do on Pinterest?
Yeah, but this is where a physical property, you can actually go in and do shopping meet people and they'll show you how they do it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So there's a lot of cool stuff there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was talking to this lady, Roxanne, and I've worked with her for over 10 years and more than that. And we were trying to talk about, you know, my journey in recovery, and I'm talking a lot about rehab and all these things and just nonchalantly. And then I realized my next interview was just right next to me and they're listening to me. And I go, hey, I'm sorry that if you know, I scared you with my rehab talk. And she was like, no, I got a brother in it right now.
Oh, see, there you go.
And so that opened up that conversation and you would have looked at these people and you would have had no idea.
Right.
And then all of a sudden we start talking about that. And it's like, hey, we probably got to talk about your gingerbread houses for a minute. You know what I
mean? Get back to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, my family, your family, everyone's family and friends were touched by it in some way.
Addiction does not discriminate. Yep. I think a lot of times people think that addiction's like, well, that person seems like they got everything going. We won't mess with them. These guys come from a broken home. Yeah, doesn't care who you are or what you do. It will get you if it can.
Well, it's been a pleasure being on the journey with you, man. I'm so happy to come over here and do this show and meet neat people like our guest today. And
her name is Charisse Ells. Did I say that right?
Yes.
And you've been sober now about 4 years.
A little over 4 years.
And your DOC, for those who don't know, drug of choice?
Methamphetamines.
Meth. And we were riding up on the elevator. I had two questions for you. One was, how long you been sober? And the second one was, what's up with methies and lawnmowers?
I don't know. We just have to take things apart.
And you said nobody's slower than a meth person in a hurry.
Yep.
We're going to find out what that means. You're listening to Project Recovery. Stick around. Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. Our guest today is Charisse Ells. And you said you've been sober a little over 4 years.
Yep.
Meth was your DOC.
Yep.
But where does the story of young Charisse begin?
Right here in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Really?
Yep. Yep. I was born way back in 1985 to a teen mom in Glendale, Utah. She did her best with me. She made sure she was never on welfare because when she grew up, she was on welfare.
Mm-hmm.
She was a very, very poverty stricken child and she wanted to make sure that I wasn't the same.
So she was driven
100%. And she worked her tail off my entire life to make sure that I had a good life.
We were multiple jobs.
Uh-huh. Yep. Multiple jobs. She landed one at what used to be called First Interstate Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's the Fargo. And
I like that. The Fargo.
Mm-hmm, and she has worked there ever since I can remember. And she's just, you know, worked her way up. And she met my dad when I was, I think when I was born, but then they got together when I was about 2 or 3 years old. And they just fought to give me the best life possible. And believe it or not, I had a really, really, really great life.
Are you an only child?
With my mom, it's myself and my little brother, but my biological father, there's a lot.
There's a lot.
A lot, yep.
And so, but it was mostly just you and your son and your mom growing up.
Me and my mom and my dad,
mm-hmm.
and then my little brother, Jacob, he was born when I was 13.
Okay.
Yeah, so for the most part, I was an only child. My mom, however, did really great. She never, ever spoke ill about my biological father. She always wanted me to try and have a relationship with him. And her and the other baby mamas, we can call them, they put all of their hatred aside for this man and let us be siblings growing up. So that was really, really great.
That's impressive.
Yeah, really great. And that further on made it so that, like, when I grew up and had children and ended up not continuing my relationship with my children's father, we are just amazing co-parents. And I attribute it to way back then.
Mom modeled that. That's a tough 100%. Thing to do. Mm-hmm. Good for her.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, did you have a relationship with your biological father, or if you didn't, why?
Yes and no. For when I was little, yes. But as I got older, I remember this time when I was 9 years old. It was my 9th birthday. And he was supposed to come and pick me up and take me to the Olive Garden because I loved the fettuccine Alfredo there. He was a little late, and we ended up going to Village Inn because he said they have fettuccine Alfredo there as well.
not the same?
Not the same. No, not the same. And we were sitting at dinner, and I remember, like it was yesterday, he said to me, "You know why I don't like you? Because you're just like your mom."
Oh.
Whoa.
Okay.
That's heavy.
Yeah.
You were how old at the time?
I was 9. It was my 9th birthday.
It was on your birthday.
Yep.
Yep.
It was my 9th birthday. And, you know, like I said, my mom never spoke ill of him, you know?
Yeah.
And so for him to say that, like, and I look at my mom and I mean, she's a boss. Like, she's everything.
She sounds very driven.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She is.
And
she is.
Mature in her attitude about how to raise you.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's strange that he would pop off with that.
Well,
I think that was more about him than you.
Oh yeah, no, for sure,
well,
for
100%,
sure. And as I've gotten older and you know, been around so many different types of people, you know, like, do I love the man? Yes. I also remember one time he told me, I think it was maybe a year later, that he stepped aside so that Brenda and Will could raise me. Oh, okay. Thank you.
He wanted a pat on the back.
Right. And now, thank you. Thank you for doing that.
It was probably best.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So do you remember the first time you tried alcohol or drugs?
Yes.
Why?
Well, the first time alcohol, I think I was 17 at my aunt's wedding. And I had a glass of wine because it was fancy and the thing to do. So, but the first time I did meth, it was actually a very traumatic experience for me. It wasn't a chosen thing for me.
Oh.
Yeah. So I was actually 29 years old when that happened.
So up until 29, do you think you had a pretty safe relationship with alcohol?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there were times I'd get obliterated for sure on a weekend party. And when I was a teenager, probably like 18, 19, smoked a lot of pot.
But what most people would consider typical behavior.
I think we have to allow room for experimentation.
For sure.
And
for
kids do that.
Yeah.
And when kids drink, teenagers and young adults, they tend to binge drink, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
my ex-wife would say, overshot your window.
That's a nice way to say it.
That's good.
Hey, Casey, looks like you overshot your window.
Yeah.
Par for the course.
Yeah.
Par for the course.
And so how do you, it sounds like, accidentally or?
No, it was more, for lack of a better word, forced upon.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, let's get into it.
Yeah.
So I was, after I had my children, I was 19 and 20 years old when I had them. Then their father and I literally sitting on the couch one day, and I think my little Liam was like 6 months old, just a little guy. And we just said, this isn't working, you know? So we just split ways and have literally been best friends ever since. He's been very supportive of me in everything that I've done in life, even when I met my second husband, who we are no longer together because there was a lot of narcissism and abuse, all kinds, sexual. There was a lot of mental abuse and physical abuse. And so one night at our cute little house, I woke up and he just had this like evil look in his eyes. And I was like, who are you? What is going on? And he informed me that he had done some meth. And at the time I was mad because I stuck my nose up to people who did drugs. Like I didn't understand because my mom made sure that I was very, very put away from all of that.
Sheltered.
Yeah. Very sheltered from that. You know, she has a brother that was a hardcore drug addict for a very long time, who also now is in recovery and doing great in his life. But, you know, my mom didn't want me to be a part of that. And so I was angry, and I'm like, get out. And he didn't. And we were sitting at the kitchen table, and he had some crushed up on the table and really just shoved it up my nose and plugged my nose. Oh, and so that was the first experience that I had with meth. Looking back at it, like, I'm not mad at him for it.
Why not?
You know, because if not for that moment, I wouldn't be who I am today.
Okay. So you've reframed that experience.
100%.
You might have been a little mad at the time.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. I was. I mean, but, well, the next 17 hours of being awake and doing all the fun stuff, no, I wasn't mad.
So that was my question, because forced upon. Was it a fun experience?
Yeah, it was. It was.
But it might have been scary and a little panicky.
It was. Yeah, it was super at first.
You know,
panicky
having something
scary.
Like that mm-hmm. forced upon you.
But at some point, he had a conversation with you. See, this is fun, don't you think?
Yeah, and it was. And we went from doing it like maybe once a year, recreational, and then like the abuse got worse between us. And then it just got to the point where after I finally decided to leave him, he knew the one thing that could hurt me was to make sure that I never saw his children that I raised. And so he did that. And from there, I didn't know what else to do. So I was just like, screw it. Let's do some meth.
So that was your thought process.
Uh-huh. Yep.
So it was sort of, would you say, partly self-medicating to deal with this stress mm-hmm. and loss and sadness of all those relationships?
Yeah.
So, a coping mechanism. That's what alcohol mm-hmm. was always for me. And so it sounds like you went through some trauma, grieving some loss. Not sure what to put your emotion, how to feel about your feelings. Mm-hmm. And you went to something that you thought would take it away or mm-hmm. help you cope with it at least.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And did it at first?
It did. It did. And the people, like, I was very fortunate to be, I guess they call it an addict that can function, a functioning addict at first, at least.
Yeah. That's a lie for everybody.
Well, for sure. But at the time, you know, I made myself believe that. I was a function. I had a job. I still took care of my kids. I still paid my bills.
And that's a common way to justify use, right?
Right.
Is like, I'm not like everybody else.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, I go to work every day.
I'm paying my bills. I'm
right.
Stuff,
right.
I'm not hawking stuff for meth. I got cash.
Right. Exactly. And then I learned how to sell meth. And then so it was a double whammy. Like, I had an on-paper job, so that was great. And then I started selling meth, and then I started meeting people in what they call the game. And, you know, these people, like, they, at the time I thought, oh, they understand me. They love me. They're there for me. They know what I'm going through.
How quick did it escalate?
Rather quickly.
I mean, are we talking, so, you know, you separate from husband number two. Mm-hmm. He won't let you see the kids you raised. Mm-hmm. You're feeling down, starting to self-medicate and start doing meth. Does it go every day, or does it at first start out once a week, every other day?
Yeah, I would call myself a tweekend warrior.
Or tweekend.
A tweekend warrior.
I think that's a new phrase for the show.
I've never heard it.
So on the weekends, you know. And then it would just progressively be every day.
And then it's Monday, Tuesday.
And then it's every day of the tweak.
Well, I mean, that's how it started with alcohol.
Yeah.
I mean, I
think that's a pretty, you know, the week gets a lot shorter, mm-hmm. right? The weekend mm-hmm. gets a lot longer.
You know, I was drinking on Taco Tuesday, First Thursday.
Right. You home day Wednesday. You got to have a drink on Wednesday.
That's right. That's right.
Thursday's almost the weekend. So
you got to celebrate.
And so then it started going quicker.
Yeah, quicker and quicker. I can tell you now, the entire length of my addiction went from the age of 29 to 34. So in the grand scheme of things, 5 years is really not that much time. But I went from having everything to a prison sentence. So.
Ooh, we're going to get to that in a second. But how does it start to unfold for you? Because, I mean, to end up in prison, I mean, it had to start to deteriorate, fall apart, if you will.
Yeah.
And so how did you lose your job?
I actually ended up quitting. I never really got fired from a job.
Had you stayed, would you have got fired?
Probably.
Because I think a lot of times that people say, they go, well, I didn't get fired. Well, if you would have stayed, you would have been fired.
Yeah.
You just beat him to the punch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I would have definitely gotten fired because I would have started calling in more. But then I was able to get jobs. Like, I was an Uber driver.
Mm.
Yeah, that was
that cool. Makes me feel safe.
Careful. But yeah, I ended up, after I had moved out from the house that my husband at the time and I lived in, I had moved out and got an apartment, and he was also using at the time. And I mean, it's not his story, it's not my story to tell, so I won't get too far into it. But there was one time my kids walked to school and they came home and told me, "Mom, I'm pretty sure I saw him following us to school." Like, I had moved them schools. And so there was a time he had come over in the middle of the night banging on my door, like wanting pictures. And I'm like, "What are you talking about? What pictures?" Like, I thought, because I was twacked out, I thought, "Oh, you want to come in my house and take pictures because you, you know, being very sus about things." And then I had gone to work one day. I was working for Obamacare. And my sister was living with me, and she had called me and said, "Hey, he's here because he wants to take pictures," again with the pictures. So I get home, and I remember him running after my car with a mallet.
Wow.
And my apartment complex got it on video. And so they called the cops, and they, you know, I did a statement, and the city of Sandy asked me to put a protective order on him, which, okay, you know, because at this point, like, there is no reconciling this relationship. And so after that, 2 days later, I got an eviction notice on my door. Not because I didn't pay, but because I was disturbing the peace.
They didn't want that kind of nonsense.
Exactly. Don't blame them. Who does?
And so let me ask you this. Where are your kids during all of this?
For the first few years, they were still with me. And then as soon as I lost that apartment, I guess it was in the first few years, it was in the first year. As soon as I lost that apartment, so I left him in February of 2015. And this was September of 2015 now at this point. So I went to my mom, and I pretty much said, "I am going down a bad path and I need help." And my mom, knowing that she raised me better, said to me, "Well, your kids can stay here, but you can't." Because, like, during this marriage to this person, I wasn't allowed to see my parents. My parents had helped me take out a very large loan to help pay off some of his debt. And then if I would go to the bank or try to go to the bank to pay the bill, he would, like, "No, your parents can afford it." And then there would be physical abuse and stuff like that. And so it just got to the point where, like, I didn't want
it. So your mom had seen your life unravel.
Yeah, my mom had seen my life unraveling, but she never wanted to admit, like, "Oh, she's probably on drugs right now." So when my mom told me, "Your kids can stay here, but you can't," well, I said, "Nope." And I went to my friend's house, and which, you know, looking back at it now, we can call it a trap house for sure.
A trap house is where they sell drugs, Dr.
Yes.
Matt.
Yes.
Was that right?
Yeah. That is right. And this person who I thought was my friend, I asked him one day if he could watch my kids because I had to go to work because here I was still working. And I had this feeling like I need to go home. So I went home during lunch and I found my sons, both of them, and the person I asked to watch them in the walls. Literally had taken a portion of the wall out and they were in the walls. And I freaked out. "What are you doing? What's going on?" And they said, "Oh, we're looking for the tunnels." Oh. So that was the point where I called my mom and I said, "Okay, you need to come get my kids."
Were they high?
My kids, no.
Okay.
No. But the person was. Yeah.
And so he was taking them on, like,
yeah,
this
my kids
fun
were
adventure.
Little. They were, yeah, yeah.
Trying to find tunnels in the walls.
Yeah, my kids were 9 and 10 at the time.
All right.
Yeah. And so I called my mom. She came and got them. And, you know, I try to lay out guidelines. They are my children. You can't keep them from me. Like, I'm struggling. I need to find a good, solid place to be. Got to get another job. You know, just all these things. And so at first, like, I was coming over all the time. And then that time got shorter and shorter. And then, like, at the time, I felt my mom wasn't allowing me to come over. I look back now. She was just protecting my children.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But that's got to do something to you personally, you know what I mean? Because here you are trying to do the best you can, and around every corner you're coming up short.
Yep.
And now your kids can't even live with you.
Right, right. And they couldn't live with their dad either at the time. So their dad has never done drugs in his life. Their dad is an amazing man. Like I said earlier, he's my best friend. He had started working at UPS, and he was in that transition from working in the warehouse to being a driver. And at the time, I don't know how it is now, but at the time, that transition was like you had to put your bids in every day or every week for your route.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the apartment that we got evicted from, he also lived there with us. And so now we were both kind of screwed, nowhere to go. So he was living in his car, going to like Planet Fitness, showering every day to get to go to work. So, you know, he would, on the weekends, he would go and he would rent a hotel room, a nice hotel room for my kids to come and spend time with him. And so it was really, really rough, you know, and I think at that point doing more drugs was helping me get past that. At least I thought.
Try to deal with the stress and all that. Sounds like, you know, when it rains, it pours kind of thing, right? Yep. And so instead of just dealing with one problem.
But what you don't understand, Dr. Matt, is when you're an addict and it starts pouring, you don't blame yourself.
No. I was a victim of that. You know,
and that's the hard part for somebody who's not an addict. They go, well, maybe you should just stop what you're doing. Right. You know, and you're like, well, no, this is not me. I'm doing everything I can just to get through this downpour, not realizing that we're making it rain.
Right.
And so now you're seeing your kid less and less, your kids less and less. And you're starting to blame your mom.
Yep. Because she wouldn't let me come over. How dare her? She wouldn't let me live with her when I just needed the help. You know, when I never said, Mom, I'm doing meth. I need help. No, I just said, I'm going down a wrong path.
It sounds like your mom's kind of a, you know, a driven, tough lady.
100%.
Sets boundaries.
Absolutely.
Did she ever challenge you on that? Like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Did she try to challenge drug use?
I think just because I was such a brat for a while that she was just like, she wanted to make sure that my kids were protected because she didn't know if I was going to go back to him or not. And she knew that there was physical abuse. There was one time, Halloween, we went to a Halloween party and he dropped me off at like 3 a.m. at my parents' after he had just demolished my face and my mom didn't even recognize who I was. So my mom, I think, and I've never really even asked her, but I think her whole like thought process in this was to take Hayden and Liam away from that and make sure that they were raised in the same kind of household I was.
And some people just don't want to be lied to.
You know what I mean? There is that.
You know, it's just like, look, I'm not going to get in this fight with you because you're just going to lie to me. Yep. I don't have time or the care to even do this. And if you come to me and said, I bet dimes of dollars, if you'd have came to her and said, Mom, I'm doing meth, I need help. She would have been, what can we do?
Yep.
But I don't want to sit here and have you lie to me.
Right. Yep.
So how does it go from there? Sounds like it gets worse.
Yeah. So during this time, I had actually met my current husband now, selling drugs. And we had, during our addiction, we had a very up and down relationship for sure. I mean, when I first met him, I thought he was the cutest thing on the planet, which he is. Don't get me wrong. But we were pulling ourselves in different directions. Like I wanted so bad to have like this fairy tale, but not give up the meth. And I believe he also wanted this fairy tale, but didn't want to give up the heroin and the meth that he was on. And so, he had gone to jail a couple times. Well, actually prison a couple times. And, at this point I've never had a record in my life, you know? And the first time he went to prison, I didn't know what to do cause I'd never been with anybody that went to prison. And so, you know, I would try and answer the phone as much as I could, but I didn't really have money to be putting on the phone or sending him money. And so like, I would be like, oh yeah, I put it on your books. And obviously I didn't, you know? So then there became like a huge like trust barrier between him and I. And then he got out and we reconciled things. And at this point, we'd actually moved to Ogden, Utah, of all places.
Biggie, you know.
Yep, trying to stay sober there.
Yeah.
And I know that like we had had this trust issue because while he was in prison, I wasn't being fully honest about what I was doing, if I was or wasn't doing drugs, if I was working or not. And so when he had gotten out of prison and we got an apartment up in Ogden, you know, my mindset was, if you ask me, I'll tell you.
But I'm not just going to give it to you.
But I'm not just going to give it to you. So then there we go again, lying, omitting, you know. So I ended up moving in with my childhood best friend's parents. Up in Ogden, and he started kind of hitting it hard in the paint and wasn't, him and I weren't talking very much, and he ended up going to jail again, and he called me, and then we're going to try and work on things. And so this was kind of our relationship for quite a while. And then in August of, well, I guess it was more like July of 2019, him and I had gotten into such a big fight that I had moved down to Price, Utah, all these great places to try and stay away from drugs. And so I had moved down to Price, Utah. In this breakup at the time, he had actually given me our truck. Her name was Beige Betty. So I had moved down there, and I went down to Panguitch from Price. Oh, no, I had court somewhere down there. And I was driving through a canyon in Panguitch, and the back tires on my truck had caught a little bit of gravel, and I ended up rolling into the mountain. Not off the mountain, but into the mountain. And I remember I had to call my mom to come and get me, a 4-hour drive. And so she did. Mm-hmm. But as soon as she got there, my roommate and Price also showed up. Mm. And so I was like, well, I can go with my mom, or I could probably go have a shot of meth with my friend, you know? And so that's what I did instead. I had gotten an opportunity to come to Salt Lake and pick up a car and drive it to California. That was the only information that I was given. Drive it to California.
Yeah, but you knew.
Yeah, I mean, so the information was drive this car to California, go pick up this other car. We're going to give you this much money. Shoot, okay. Well, me being ridiculously in love with my husband, I call. I'm like, do you want to go make some money with me this weekend? Well, sure, because I knew the way to his heart at the time was like, let's go make some money. Sure. So we drive to California in this car, and he was on parole at the time. And so he was like, is there anything in the car? And I'm like, no. Why would they have? No, there wasn't. And as far as I know to this day, there was nothing in that car. So we get to California. When I get to California, the person who I'm delivering the car to calls me and says, you want to go to Mexico?
Yeah.
Okay. Why not? Let's go to Mexico. We got beachfront property. All will be well. So we did. We drove into Mexico when we stayed in Rosarito, Mexico. And I was offered an even larger amount of money to strap myself with methamphetamines and walk across the border.
They wanted you to be a mule.
Yep. So I did.
Mm. How much?
The first night, because I did it twice, spoiler alert. The first night, I don't even know how much, but it was literally, I was strapped from my shins up to my chest, all the way around my legs, all the way around my waist, all the way, you know, up on my bust, just strapped full. And I walked across the border, and I tell you what, that was, other than being ridiculously high on meth, to walk across the border with pounds of methamphetamines was a ridiculous high. Ridiculous high. So I got asked.
How much money?
It was a few thousand dollars.
Not enough.
No. Not now. No, thinking about it now.
Never.
No. I was really high at the time.
What do you think?
The answer's never. Yeah.
What do you think the worth of the drugs on you might have been?
I would probably say upwards to $30,000, probably.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you go through the first time, mm-hmm. and you said that in itself was a high.
Yeah.
Crossing the border.
Yeah, crossing the border. It was.
And for people who haven't done that, I've driven across but never walked. Mm-hmm. Like, what is the screening process?
There's really, I mean, like I said, at the time, I had never.
Do you just have to show a passport?
Or my ID, because I don't have a passport.
Okay.
Yep.
And at that time, I don't think you needed a passport to get. No. Yeah, to go across.
You don't need a passport now.
Oh, no, you don't still?
I'm not to walk. I'm guessing the whole job is do not look like you're carrying drugs.
Correct.
But yeah. they don't do a scan or like nothing like the airport. Nope.
So you make it through, you get your $2,000, you give them $30,000 worth of meth.
So I didn't even get my $2,000 yet because, okay, I made it across, mm-hmm. and we're going to triple or nothing it for you. You want to do it again? And I'm like, sure. My husband, we're sitting in our motel room, and my husband was like, you are stupid. You are getting greedy. This is stupid. Don't do it again. Let's just go.
I'm guessing these people had done this before, and they just keep running you across the border until you get caught.
Looking back now, I'm assuming.
And they don't have to pay you at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we're in San Ysidro, California, my husband and I. And, you know, he's just trying to talk me out of it. And I'm like, dude, like, it's a lot of money. Like, think of the stuff we could do with this money. And he's just like, nope, you're being stupid. You're being greedy. He goes, I'm not going with you this time. I'm okay. So he had gone into Mexico with me. He had walked out a few hours before because he was on parole. Like, we're not trying to make it so, you know, suspicious. And I didn't want to throw him back in prison.
Yeah.
So I told him, if I get caught, it'll be a slap on the wrist. And he's like, you're stupid. So I remember right before I walk back over the border with no drugs, we had stopped at Starbucks. And he had gotten his coffee, went to the bathroom, and he comes and he sits outside and he gave me, so my favorite way to do meth was to snort it. And so he'd given me a big shard and he said, here, this is for you, go in the bathroom. Okay, cool, thanks. So I go in the bathroom and I remember I crushed it and I snorted it and I looked in the mirror and I don't know if I was this high or not, but I looked in the mirror and I said, I don't know if I was talking to God or myself, but I said, let this be the last amount of dope I ever do. Don't let me encourage him anymore, meaning my husband. You know, I didn't want this life for us anymore. I said, but just let this be the last amount of dope I ever do. Don't let me encourage him anymore. So I leave the bathroom and I am high at this point, super duper high. And so I go and I buy tacos and I walk back across the border, leaving my husband there. And I noodle around with the person in Mexico and I have to go get a new outfit because you can't wear the same outfit over the border. You know, got to get a whole new outfit.
Yeah.
And, you know, we got to make sure it's going to hide things appropriately.
Poncho.
Right.
That'd
yeah.
work.
Ooh. Yeah. So we go do that. I remember I drank four Locos.
Not good.
No, not good at all. On top of meth, on top of not eating for 3 days, you know? Yeah. And so at this point, the person in Mexico is his wife that was strapping me with the drugs. And I remember she had a package that she said to put inside of me.
Oof.
And I said, no. In fact, my exact words were, I have morals. I know, crazy. But so I said, no. But I had two pairs of Spanx on. You guys know what Spanx are?
Yeah.
Okay. So I had two pairs. So in between the two pairs of Spanx, I had put this package, okay? And then around my bust, we had strapped 4.5 kilos.
Now, do you do this with Velcro or duct tape?
Yep. Duct tape. It was
just
tape.
Another use for that tape.
Yep.
I like the engineering mind mm-hmm. you got going on.
I think it was
on,
actually
right?
Gorilla tape,
yeah.
to be honest.
Well, you know, it's actually duct, D-U-C-T,
yeah.
not
yeah, because
D-U-C-K.
It's made for the ducks.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. I yep. knew that. Yeah, yep. Thanks, though.
So they strap me. And then I walk, or they drop me off at the border, or the little place where they drop you off, which you got to walk like a half a mile maybe. And I'm walking, and I remember he says to me, make sure you stay up against the wall. Okay. So I'm staying against the wall, and I don't know if I tripped or what, but I had flip-flops on, and I was wasted, and I may have tripped a little bit. And this officer stops me. Or I'm walking, and he says, ma'am. And I just am like, nope, just keep walking. And he goes, ma'am. And I turn around, and he goes, what do you have on you? I said, nothing. And I just kept walking. He goes, you need to stop. So I stopped. And
was
he,
this a federale or was this a U.S.
It was a border
cop?
Patrol. Border patrol.
Okay.
Yeah, it was border patrol. And he had his dog with him. And his dog kept like hitting where that package was, the package that they wanted to put inside of me. And I was like, can you get your dog to stop? And he's like, stop. I'm like, hitting me. And he goes, well, maybe if you'd take the drugs out, we wouldn't have this problem. I don't have any drugs on me. I don't know what you're talking about. And so if you couldn't tell, I'm a tall woman. I'm 6 feet tall, just about. And this officer was really short. And I was looking down at him and I was angry with him. I was so mad. And so I try and pull out my phone to try and text like a word so that the person on the other side knew, like, I'm not coming back. You should probably just get on the train and go home, you know? And so he tells me to put my phone away and he gets a lady officer to come over. And at first, like, she starts feeling and she can't feel anything on me. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to get away with it. And so then she takes me into this big, like, cement room, and she just starts patting me down even more. And she feels the duct tape on my side. She said, what is this? And I said, I'm very large busted, and I'm just taping them down. And she didn't think that was funny. I did. But so she then unstrapped me, and then I had pulled out the package that the girl had asked me to put inside of me. And so the officer said, look, and she pointed at it and there was a slit in the package. So how you guys know those, like those freezer safe, like suck all the air out.
Yeah.
The
Ziploc bags.
Yeah. But it's not a Ziploc. Like it's the actual like machine kind.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And so that how they did it is they wrapped it twice in that and then they would saran wrap it and wrap it again. So there's no way unless you purposely put a slit in it that there's a slit. So there was a slit in it and there was like some powdered stuff. Okay, whatever, I'm caught at this point. Like, I'm thinking, all right, book and release me. I get to go home.
So you think you were set up?
Yeah. Now I do, yeah. Because after I got the papers, I thought they'd take me to jail, they'd book and release me, and I'd get to call my mom, fly me home, call it a day. No, that is not what happened. I got to sit at the border for 8.5 hours, and they brought in the FBI.
Ooh.
To ask me questions. And I'm a very sarcastic person, and that is how I deal with things.
And FBI loves that.
Well, this guy, his name was Ryan. And he kept telling me, like, you are an intelligent human being. And I'm like, yeah. Why did you do this? I'm like, for the money, you know, like, and I'm being honest with him. And he's like, what's the guy's name? And I said, if I give it to you, are you going to go to Mexico and go get him? No. So these are my drugs. They're mine. So after about 2 hours of interrogation, they were like, okay, so these are just your drugs. Yep, they're my drugs. So they slid a piece of paper over, and it was an indictment waiver, meaning nobody else could ever be indicted on this case but me, because I'm taking full responsibility. I went to Mexico and I got the drugs. They're mine. So I'm thinking, okay, do I get to go home now? And they're like, oh, no. Mm-mm. You can go back out there and sit and wait. And so they handcuffed me back to the bench for another couple hours. And then everybody that was handcuffed to the bench, we all got put in a white van and taken to MCC Federal Prison.
Ooh, what is that?
That's in San Diego. It's the federal prison in San Diego.
Wow.
Do not pass go. You don't get to be booked and released. You are now a federal inmate. Congratulations.
How many people were with you?
Well, we had two full vans, so there was a lot. I mean, with me personally, on my experience on my journey, it was just me, but you know, there was a lot of other women that had been asked to do this as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now you're a federal inmate.
I am. Yep. With 3 first degree felonies. And now I'm on the terrorist watch list on top of it all.
That puts you on the terrorist watch list?
Yep, because I was committing a crime against the United States.
Ah.
And I was trying to bring drugs in to harm. Essentially, they look at it like I was harming others.
Yeah, okay.
So you don't go before a judge?
Well, yes, I did. I go before a judge. And then, I guess it was probably 7 days before I went before a judge. But before that, I had an attorney come and talk to me. And he had brought these papers, you know. And again, I'm still thinking, I'm getting a slap on the wrist. Like, I've never been in trouble a day in my life. I have a suspended driver's license. Like, woo. And
I love her optimism.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, at the time, because like I said, and so he brings in this huge stack of like my case, and it says right on there, minimum mandatory 10 to life. Oh, what? And I was like, well, but you know, and I'm trying to plead my case to this lawyer. Like, I've never been in trouble. There's gotta be something I can do. Like, plea in abeyance, something. And he was like, nope, minimum mandatory. I didn't like him, so I fired him.
Mm.
And so then my next attorney comes, and he was a great guy. He was like, you know what? What's the worst they're going to do? Say no? Yep, that's the worst they're going to do. So he thought that they could get me down to 6 years. Okay, I'll take 6 years over life for sure, any day.
Still, though, that must have been daunting. Yeah,
it was scary, because I wasn't really scared until that moment of, oh, crap, like, I'm never going to see my kids again. They're going to have to talk to me through a telephone all the time. Like, these are the things that like started like my aha moments of, what have you done with your life, you idiot, you mm-hmm. know? And so that was August 12th, 2019 is when I had gotten arrested. And then they took me to MCC Federal. In that paperwork that they had given me, it had stated the purity of the methamphetamines that I had. And it was 0.02% away from being 100% pure.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And does that influence the charges then?
It could, but at the time that I crossed the border, the drugs are classed 1 through 5, right? Worst being 1, least being 5, what have you. Number 1 was meth at the time.
Mm.
And the amount of meth that they had caught me with was 4.5 kilos. So I was pretty screwed on that one. And then the next was heroin. And then the next, I believe, was cocaine. And then the one after that was fentanyl. So like this was right before fentanyl became like this huge, terrible thing.
Now, do you imagine fentanyl's number 1?
Now, yeah, it is now. 3 weeks after I had been arrested and my charges had been given to me, that's when fentanyl became number 1.
Mm.
So that slit, there was 1.75 grams of pure fentanyl in that slit in the package.
Why would they set you up, do you think? Like, what?
Because they didn't want to pay me.
Ah, okay. So they're just tired.
It was just a way to get their drugs over the border.
So the mule. Yeah. So they have so much extra that that's worth it to them to
because,
get you
because
caught.
The first night I had so much, you know, and then this night, and I thought to myself, 4.5 kilos, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But then these girls that I'm sitting there with, like, their Suburbans were full. Like, their tires were full.
Oh,
like,
136,
140 kilos.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah, so, I mean, I was
They were just getting rid of you.
Yeah, it was small business for sure.
So the lawyer says he thinks he can get you down to 6.
Right.
And you go, okay.
Okay. Yeah. Like, sure. What can I do to get good time? What are the things that I can do? You know? And so after I had spoken with the second lawyer, they had actually transferred me to the Chula Vista Police Department. So in the Chula Vista Police Department underneath, there used to be a female federal holding cell. And the police officers, not even COs, but police officers were our babysitters. And it was in a basement. There were no windows. So for the next 8.5 months, I stayed in the basement of a police department with a bunch of other girls. Yikes.
Wow.
Yeah. No yard. Like, if we wanted to go out in the yard, it was in the parking garage of the police station. So, like, I didn't see the sun.
So you were really indoors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We didn't even have a kitchen. Like, we had our food, like, was brought into us in these little, like, microwavable dinner things that were terrible. Beans in every meal. I don't eat beans anymore. I will never eat a bean ever.
So 8.5 months there.
Mm-hmm.
Then what changes?
So like I said, it was August 12th that I get arrested, and I try and call my mom. She doesn't answer. I try and call my dad. He doesn't answer. I try and call my oldest son. Doesn't answer. My youngest son doesn't answer. Try call baby daddy. He doesn't answer. Called my husband a couple times. He did answer, but he came to the conclusion that, like, I'm probably going to change my life after this. So he probably shouldn't talk to me because he wasn't ready to change his life yet. So I talked to him a couple times. After about 30 something days, my mom finally answered the phone. Mm. And she said to me, "Got yourself into a pickle this time, didn't you?" I said, "Yep." She said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I don't know." She goes, "Well, you got a lot of time to think," and hung up the phone. Okay. So then I tried calling my kids some more, and my youngest son answered the phone at about 60 something days that I was in there. At about 90 something days, my oldest son, Hayden, it was his 15th birthday. Ooh, this part makes me emotional. He was telling me all about how great his birthday was, because it was his birthday, 15th birthday, how great his birthday was. And so I asked him, "Can you send me some pictures? It sounds great." And he asked me what my federal U.S. Marshal inmate number was.
Mm.
So that time, like, he's my firstborn, like, he's the one who changed my life all around, you know, for him to ask me what my number was. I felt like I was no longer his mom at that point. So, like, my husband used to tell me this quote, and it was my favorite quote, and it goes, "Every life has its waking moment." And so my son, Hayden, is my waking moment. The first time that he was born and up to that day. And so from that moment, like, I just knew that I had to change my life. And so at this point, my lawyers come in every week to talk to me, like, "Here's the things you can do. Go to NA meetings, attend church, do, you know," even though you're countied out, there's still things you can do to try and get good time and show that you're doing all these good things. So, about December, I find out that my lawyer is going on paternity leave. And I'm like, "No, I really like you. Like, what are we going to do?" So the person who replaced him, her name was Jessica Olive. And she was the best attorney on the planet. The best. She came in just this cute young little thing. And I was like, "What can I do? Like, what?" And she goes, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I don't know. Credit for time served. Like, maybe this." And she goes, "All right, let's ask." Oh, okay. So during this time, I'm writing my parents' letters. I'm writing my kids' letters. I'm writing my husband's letters. Like, I am trying to find forgiveness for myself. I'm writing my grandparents' letters and letting them know, like, here is everything I've ever done. I'm a jerk. I'm sorry. If you can't forgive me, I understand. But I need you guys to know, like, I'm working on forgiving myself because this isn't the human being that I am. And with that, like, I got my grandpa, my cute old grandpa, he wrote me a letter. And it was a very lengthy letter for sure. But the very beginning said, "To my eldest grandchild, I need you to know I forgive you for all of your transgressions." So, like, that was like my first, like, oh, these bridges that I've burned, it's just a bridge. You can build it again. Do it, you know? So I, you know, like most people who go to jail or prison, I found God. Even though being raised in Utah in a predominantly Mormon community, like, I wasn't sure what I felt or knew or believed in when it came to a God. My mother raised me on karma. you get what you give, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I opened up a Bible and read the entire Bible while I was there. And I worked on a lot of things. And so during all of this, a pandemic started.
Yeah.
And like, I had no idea what was going on outside because we didn't get to see outside. I remember that, I think it was January 2020, I found out that I could be bailed out for free. The person who bailed me out just had to be worth $15,000. That was it. So I asked my mom and she said no. And a lot of people, when I tell my story at work, they'll ask me, were you mad at your mom for that? No. My mom didn't tell me no a lot in my life. And she knows when I need to be told no. And that was the time that I needed to be told no, for sure.
So who'd you call?
I stayed there. I didn't. I knew at that point, like, God has a purpose for me to be here. So just continue on this path. And so I was supposed to go to court. I think it was end of February, but it got canceled. Why? Because of the pandemic. And then I was supposed to go in March, and then it got canceled. And during this whole time that I'm there, from August now all the way up to March, like, I had missed every important thing that I had never missed, even on drugs. I missed every football practice. I missed every birthday. I missed Christmas. I missed Thanksgiving. I missed the first day of high school for my, like, I was missing all of these super important milestones that I had never missed before. So March comes around and again, my date gets pushed back and I'm just like, what is going on? And, I remember I got an email from my mom so they could email us and then the lieutenant would print it off and give it to us. And it was from my mom. And all it said was, we're okay. What do you mean we're okay? Well, then the first one finally came through and it was the day that Utah had their earthquake. And so my mom was trying to tell me, well, that night, I had called my mom and she said, have you heard? The world is shut down. What the hell? What do you mean the world is shut down? And so, like, you know, the lieutenant and all the officers are trying to tell us, like, this COVID thing isn't really that big of a deal, which for us it wasn't because we were
quarantined already.
We were super quarantined for sure. You know,
you were original quarantine.
The OGs.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm asking my mom to call my lawyer because I couldn't get a hold of my lawyer. Like, what's going on with my date? Like I need to know what's going on. So my mom, she kept emailing me, okay, it looks like it's this date. Okay, it looks like this date. And I'm like, I kept telling myself, I swear to God, if I have to spend my 35th birthday in prison, I am going to die, you know? And so my mom messages me and says, okay, you have court April 3rd. Okay, April 3rd, we'll see. April 3rd rolls around and it is 4 in the morning and they wake me up. Charisse, get up, let's go. I'm going to court today, cool. So I'm the only one in the little bus thing. And then I get to the courthouse at the federal courthouse in San Diego. I'm the only one there. Like, if you go the couple times that I had gone before, there were a whole bunch of people. Like, there's 20 of you in a cage and there's like 10 cages, you know? So there was a lot of people. This time I was the only one there. The officer comes and gets me to takes me into the courthouse or into the courtroom. And I remember I look at the podium and there's not my lawyer. Oh, really quickly, my lawyer did tell me. She came and saw me a week before this, and she said, your judge hates sarcasm. Lovely. Lovely. What am I going to do? So she said, you just sit there. Yes, sir. No, sir. Just be truthful, honest, whatever. So I get there, and my lawyer is not there. But he has, the guy who's standing there has two cell phones. My mom's on one and my lawyer's on the other. And he is standing in for my lawyer because my lawyer had just gotten COVID.
Oh.
Of course. And so I'm sitting there and, you know, the judge, it's federal, so they know everything about your life. And he goes back and he's like, you know, you've never not had a job. So I don't understand, like, what happened, you know? And I just told him, like, I'm a drug addict and I was just down a wrong path and I just didn't know what else to do with my life. And so the guy that was representing my lawyer said, we are asking for credit for time served. Excuse me. And we are asking that she do community service for 200 hours, specifically working with unsheltered addicts, just so I could see where I would have been.
Mm-hmm.
and 6 months of in-home incarceration. And the judge, he looked angry, but he wasn't. He looked and he said, you know what? I'm going to grant this for you. As of April 6th, you will have credit for time served. You will have this amount of time to get on an airplane, to go home, check in, and, you know, and then you'll be in home incarceration for 6 months. Okay, cool. So, by the way, April 6th is my birthday.
Oh.
Wow.
I know.
So you didn't have to spend
your
birthday
there. I did not have to spend my birthday there. When I got back to the holding cell, all of my stuff had been moved from my cell into this other cell, which was the medical cell. That was the only cell without a phone in it. All of our cells had phones in it, but that one didn't. And I'm like, how am I supposed to call my mom? How am I supposed to figure stuff out, you know? And I was like, why are you putting me here? And they're like, because you've been out in the world.
Oh, yeah, you can't go back to the general population.
Yeah. And so I couldn't go. And this, it was a very, very small place. Like, it was shaped like a U, and there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 cells. That was it. Like, it was very small.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't, I couldn't be with them. And so I'm like, how am I supposed to get a hold of my mom? And so Officer Jackson, she was amazing. She was texting my mom, and she would come over and show me her cell phone, like, and just like, just getting everything. She would made sure that I had my ID and my property so that my mom could get my plane ticket home. My lawyer's assistant came and picked me up at 8 a.m. on April 6th, stopped at Starbucks because good God, I needed a good cup of coffee. And she dropped me off at the airport, and I got to the airport, and I flew a lot when I was a kid. My grandparents live in Vegas, so, you know, every summer I'd go. Airports are busy. There was no, it was crickets.
It was a weird time.
Yeah, nobody was there. And I remember I got on the plane, and there were a total of 4 passengers, and we had to sit 6 rows apart from each other. So it went the first 2 passengers, and then me, and then the U.S. Marshal behind me. Because I couldn't fly alone.
Yeah.
Because I was still property of the feds.
Yeah.
So I got home, I checked in. I think this was a moment that, like, I could have gone either way. So I came home to this person who I thought was my friend, said that he had gotten a 1-bedroom apartment, that I could have the bedroom, he'd take the front room until I got back up on my feet. Well, I walk in and it was a studio apartment, and there was 1 bed there, and I was like, this is not going to happen. So the next day I went to my PO, and he had taken me to my PO, and, you know, my PO just ran down. Can't be around alcohol. Can't be around drugs. If I call you and I say jump, you say how high, you know, he put my fancy ankle monitor on, and told me that I wasn't allowed to have a job. What do you mean I can't have a job? Like, that was the whole, you know, the judge liked that I had such a good work history. Nope, couldn't have a job. So I tried to contest it, and it was hard to contest because I'm in Utah and my judge was in California, but he said, nope, you can't. And at this point I'm thinking, like, you are setting me up to fail, you know? So I'm really frustrated. I'm trying to talk to my mom about it. The guy that my friend, I thought, had left. Like, we'd gotten back to our apartment and he left, and I went to the bathroom and there was a meth pipe and a meth bong next to the toilet. So I called my PO and he didn't answer, and I left him a message. I said, I'm moving right now. This is where I'm moving. Called baby daddy and I said, I'm moving in. And he goes, I need to talk to the boys. Nope, I have to move in with you right now. So my mom came and got me and drove me all the way to Brigham City. And for the next 6 months, I lived in Brigham City. And, you know, when I say I felt like I was being set up to fail, was because, like, you just put me in jail because I had a lot of drugs. I know how to sell drugs. You know, like, I know how to make money if I can't work. Well, thank goodness for the pandemic and the money that we got for that, you know. So I was able to give half of that to my kids' dad, so I didn't feel like I was a burden on him, and I was able to give him some kind of money. But I also had to travel from Brigham City to Murray, Utah once a week or twice a week because I had to take MRT, which is moral recognition therapy. I had to do one-on-ones with a therapist. I had to drug test twice a week. And I had to pay for this.
Oh, yeah. I've been there.
Oh, yeah. I had to pay. And there was, like, the judge wouldn't waive the fees. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, what am I supposed to do? So I did it. I did everything I was supposed to. And so on October 7th, I showed up at my PO's office. I said, take this off, you know? And he did. He took it off. And on October 8th, I applied for Wasatch Recovery. And I was hired on October 17th. And I've been there ever since.
And what do you do for them now?
I am the operations manager at our outpatient building. So I run the outpatient building, everything from day treatment to our GOP, as well as our sober living.
So your rehab was a federal rehab.
Yes, it was.
It was 8 months under a police station.
Yes.
quarantined during a pandemic.
Yep.
That's a wild story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just the reason I got sober. That's all that is.
Well, so I'm curious about, you know, you got sober by force. Mm-hmm. You know, you were locked away.
Right.
And then you get out and you go to your quote unquote friend's house.
Yeah.
And there's the opportunity to do mm-hmm. drugs right there.
Mm-hmm.
Was it tempting?
No.
Tell me why, do you think?
I think just...
What had happened for you in that time?
My son asking me for my number.
Yeah.
You know, and just knowing that, like, I was not raised to be this human being. I disappointed not just myself, but everybody who has ever loved me. Mm-hmm. And I just... When I got off the plane... My mom came and picked me up, and she drove me to the In-N-Out in Farmington, and because your girl needed a burger, real
yeah,
you know,
no, I get it.
And in the parking lot was my kid's dad and my kids, and you know, Hayden, my oldest, he came and just gave me a big hug, and I remember my son Liam sitting in the back seat of his dad's car, and he just put his head down and he just started crying, mm-hmm. and I just like to be. Not a mom to your kids and to be a number and a disappointment is the worst feeling on the planet, you know? And I've asked my kids for forgiveness, and Liam, such a funny kid, he says, okay, mom, it's okay, but it's not. And he goes, you asked for my forgiveness, then I give it to you. Leave it at that. And we haven't talked about it since. I had asked my oldest for forgiveness, you know, and he is a stubborn boy. And he held on to some resentments for a really long time. On my way to California that day, I didn't have the best cell phone service and my cell phone kept going in and out. And my kids' dad had messaged me and said, hey, get to Brigham City Hospital as fast as you can. And I'm in Beaver by the time I get this. Mm. And so I call him and I'm like, what is going on? And he said, oh, Hayden had an emergency appendectomy.
Oh.
Oh, that's lovely. Okay, well, do you need me to turn around? He goes, no, it's fine. You know, what are you doing? Oh, I'm working. And he's like, yeah, just go do whatever, you know. So I talked to Hayden and he asked me to come and see him. And I said, yeah, I'll come see you in a couple days. Well, clearly I didn't because I got arrested. And up until 7 or 8 months ago, my son held on to that. And he was like, you know, I was so mad at you because you made me a promise. And that was the first promise you ever broke to me.
You've had an amazing story, and I don't want you to sell yourself short because, yeah, you were forced to get sober.
Oh, yeah.
But you did a lot of the work while you're in there.
Absolutely.
With the amends,
right.
Reading
mm-hmm.
the Bible, finding mm-hmm. a higher power. Those mm-hmm. are all things that they teach you in recovery.
Right.
And you did the work, and you had decisions, when you got to the airport, when you mm-hmm. got to the, you.
Yeah, I could have stopped and had a drink at that airport bar.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you could have done.
Mm-hmm.
So I applaud you because I think you're a very strong, intelligent, beautiful woman.
And I
think you're giving it all you got. And the fact that right after you graduate, what made you want to go work at Wasatch Recovery?
So at the time I was just kind of, back to the 200 hours of community service, having to work with unsheltered addicts. When I was going to MRT, the person who was my MRT instructor, his name was Brandon. He was a part of a nonprofit called BAM, Beyond Addiction Mosaic.
Yeah, okay. We've had him on.
Yeah. So I then became an admin for BAM. And I had done all of my community service. And I was like, this is what I want to do. You know, this is the life. I was meant to do the crap I did in my past to be who I am. I had started doing all this community service and I loved it. And I had looked online at jobs that were applying in recovery, and I had applied for two, Wasatch Recovery, and I think First Step was the other one. Whoever called me first, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it was Wasatch Recovery that called me first, and I started as a part-time grave, and I was living in Brigham City, driving to Cottonwood Heights. And it got to the point where I then worked doubles. I worked 7 days a week. Like, I wasn't taking time off, and I just fell in love with this. And then one day they were like, here, have this position, facility manager. And I was like, what, you know? And then not too long ago, they're like, oh, here, let's have you be director of operations at outpatient. And I'm like, man, like, it's just, it's, I could not have asked for a better life than I have right now.
See, that's what I love. That statement right there. Mm-hmm. That happens so much when somebody gets sober and lives a life of recovery.
Yeah.
He goes, I couldn't ask for a better life, because I feel that right now about my life. I couldn't ask for anything more than I have right now. I'm so grateful and so blessed and so humbled to be able to do these things.
Right.
Because I know that dark place you were in. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't underneath a police, you know, station.
You didn't have your breasts taped with methamphetamines.
Not this time.
Not this time. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm amazed with you. And I think it's wonderful. And I think you're doing so much good in the community. And I love what Wasatch Recovery stands for and what they're all about.
Me too.
Dr. Matt, what do you think?
Well, it's just kind of one of the things you mentioned briefly is sort of something that has been a theme of my work this week. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm a therapist and I work with lots of people on lots of different things. And one of the things that keeps coming up each day with at least one person this week, I've noticed, is this idea of people holding on and regretting their past. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of weighing them down in the mm-hmm. present. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a therapist, the goal is to help people reframe that and say, well, those situations were unfortunate or unhealthy, but they somehow, I got something out of them.
Right.
What can I take with me into the future that I learned from that? And just I don't remember exactly how you said it, but you said something like that. Mm-hmm. And I love that. Sometimes themes pop up in a person's life. So that you just emphasize that theme of my life this week is, you know, that is the healthiest way to be, mm-hmm. is to say, sure, I wish I, in some ways, you know, on some level, I wish I hadn't had hardships, right? But it is learning lessons from the hardships that help us grow
right.
and become the people that we are today. And I think you're a living example of that. And I appreciate you coming and sharing that story, because it's such a hopeful story.
It is.
And it's an optimistic story. You are an optimist. And now your optimism is helping you along mm-hmm. in helping other people. So that's wonderful.
I love it. Who we were in the past forged us into who we are now.
Do hard things.
Yeah, that's right. They do. That's right. What we do. Thank you very much for stopping by and sharing your story with Project Recovery. And in case you forgot, Project Recovery is what, Dr. Matt?
It's KSL Podcast, Casey Scott.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.